her political background that has sort of landed her where she is. She started out very young, working with the Young Democrats in Territory of Hawaii, Young Democrats in 1954 and 1956, respectively. She was the national vice president of the Young Democrats of America in 1957, and a delegate to the 1960 Democratic National Convention, a member of the Platform Committee, addressed the convention on the civil rights plank, a delegate in 1972 Democratic National Convention. Some of her other record that you'd be interested in knowing is on the congressional standing committees on which she served. And I'll just give two little bullets because there are a lot of them here. The major ones, the House Committee on Education and Labor from 1965 to 1977. Also on the committee, a House Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs from 1967 to 1977. And there are many other congressional activities, and she belongs to many organizations. She has memberships in many organizations, many honored degrees here that I don't even have time to read, but take up all the hour for her. But ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Honorable Patsy T. Meek.
Thank you very much, Chelsea. It's a real pleasure to be a part of this series. I was one of the individuals that started work years ago on the idea of having a National Women's Conference. And Bella and I worked very, very hard to get the bill through the Congress. Little did we both realize that when this conference was actually going to be convened, that we would no longer be members of the Congress or in the Senate. But you don't see us sidelined for very long. We both ran for the United States Senate in 1976 and both failed to be elected. In Bella's case, she has gone on and run for the mayoralty in New York City, and I'm sure she'll be continuing on in other activities and will continue in her leadership responsibilities, both to her state of New York as well as to the women's movement. When I ran in 1976 for the Senate, it was, of course, with the expectation of winning. And lo and behold, when the ballots were in and finally counted and I realized that I had not won the nomination on the Democratic ticket, it was quite a shock, quite a blow. And only, I think, upon returning to Washington and looking at the mounds and mounds of files and boxes and things that had to be packed, did the whole notion that 12 years of work in the Congress had come to an end. And it gave me a good deal of time to sort out my activities and my career, and to ponder what it would be in the future that would enable me to continue in my work, especially in those areas that I had gained so much experience in the field of education and labor legislation, working for child care legislation and working on the Committee on Interior on matters dealing with the environment and for the preservation of our natural resources and the development of parks and things like that, which were of the greatest significance to me. It wasn't very difficult to sort of get yourself into a gloom-doom kind of feeling that the world had come to an end and that there wasn't going to be the kind of challenges that I had enjoyed in the recent 10 or 12 years of my life. And surely as I weighed those very difficult days, I realized how much frustration and anxiety and deep depression could come upon women all over the country who had to experience this sort of a letdown, whether it is in their family or in their career or in not getting the promotion or the recognition which they so sorely deserved. And so one thing I decided as a result of that defeat was that I was not going to be a quitter. And so here I am in the most unexpected role of all, a member of that staid Department of State. there were so many friends and people who worried about what I would be doing, and since I had concentrated my activities in education, obviously they were bidding for some appointment in HEW or perhaps even in the Interior Committee, since I'd worked so hard on environmental matters. And so as the new administration was beginning to close ranks and people were being selected for various cabinet appointments and other presidential nominations, it was quite a shock when I received the phone call from Mr. Vance inviting me to come to, of all places, the State Department, where I had had the least experience. And I think that what this taught me was that really there are no limits to one's abilities and one's areas that one can make a contribution. Because it took me quite by surprise when he said that the office he had in mind for me was the Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, International Environment, and Scientific Affairs. I said, wait a minute, you have to repeat all of that again. Because even though I'd been in Washington for 12 years, quite frankly, I'd never heard of this office. And so it took many days of investigation and talking to friends and trying to find out whether this was really something in which I could make a contribution and continue the work and interest that I had in government activities. And so having made the decision to join the State Department and to become involved in the human issues, not as they confront this nation directly, but as they confront the world at large, I've found that there is indeed a place for women to make a contribution in the State Department, and I'm so happy to have been given this responsibility. Just as in the Congress, where I concern myself with education and employment opportunities and manpower training programs for women, the poverty program, child care legislation, all the things that make life difficult for so many millions in our society, which we as people of some influence and with position must begin to really get a hold of and find solutions of, one has to ponder the enormity of the problems worldwide. We recognize so many injustices right within our own country, and to conceive of the picture of the world with tenfold or 50-fold the problems we have in this country, you can imagine the challenge and the excitement that many of us face each day as we renew our responsibilities and commitment to the foreign policy responsibilities of this country. Of all the departments, not because it has the top rank in government, but of all the departments, I think it's the one that's really least understood and least supported and least acknowledged and perhaps least accepted in terms of its vitality and its significance in the ordinary human conduct of our affairs within this society. And that comes because of the fact that it deals with foreign policy and foreign relations and things that do not really concern people who have their community at interest and who have vital concerns within their own local communities. It's very hard to worry about the people in Latin America or Africa and Asia, and this makes the job in the State Department even more complex and even more challenging. Now, my area of oceans, international environment, and scientific affairs sounds very dull. Actually, it seems to me it embodies the very spirit of the Carter administration. I look upon my bureau as the bureau which will attempt to elaborate and implement the president's human rights pronouncements in the early days of this administration. It's true that when he defined originally the concept of human rights, he limited it to the perception of liberty and justice and the traditional civil rights perspective that we initially gave to that concept here in our own country. But later, as defined by the Secretary of State and by the President himself, we've come to realize that human rights cannot be an empty principle which is sold on the basis of justice and liberty and equality, but that the real heart of human rights is to try to meet the human needs of the people throughout the world, and perhaps to begin at least with those who are most in need of assistance and most in need of support. And so as I look at this basic responsibility that the President has enunciated in our foreign policy deliberations of human needs, it is my bureau that has the burden of putting it all together. I have responsibility for the energy program, the development of an alternative energy kind of perception, which we have a responsibility, I think, technically, scientifically, and in other ways, to implement, to show the way to the developing countries. Look at the vast oceans of largely unexplored resource in the world. Our oceans cover 70% of the Earth's surface, and yet very little is really known about the ocean and its tremendous role in terms of climate and atmosphere and food resource and minerals, and the potentials of the future, I think, will be found in the ocean. And so we have that general responsibility of looking to oceans policy, and in that regard set the policies for the State Department in the very important deliberations of the UN Law of the Sea, which have been ongoing for a number of years. In addition to oceans, we have all of the matters dealing with the environment. I think in the past it's been rather traditional for the people in the State Department to regard environment as simply pollution-oriented or pollution abatement or concerns with regard to the physical environment. People have not been worried about the human environment where people find themselves. So it seems to me that this administration now has an opportunity to turn to the basics of human living. Do they have water safe enough to drink? Is there enough water for them to grow their plants and to water their cattle and to take care of the basic needs of a community or a village? Is there enough water to develop electrical power so that the minimum requirements for industrialization can be met by the smallest unit of a rural village or a smaller segment of a metropolitan area? So water, housing conditions, health conditions of the people in these various areas are terribly important. You cannot simply deal with the question of environment in an abstract sense when you're dealing with the dynamics of international world politics or foreign policy. And so what we are doing in the Bureau is focusing the concerns of the White House under the leadership of Dr. Peter Bourne in such areas as international health. And for the first time, we're trying to pull together all the activities of the federal government in all the bureaus and departments of government and trying to determine what it is as a federal entity we are doing overseas in the area of health. And once we pull all of that together, make a determination of what other kinds of assistance and programs we could generate, what other ways we can join with international organizations like the World Health Organization to improve the conditions of peoples in this regard. The human settlements question, which was raised by the conference in Victoria, is also a matter of very keen interest to my bureau. That deals principally with the issues of housing, and we hope to be able to commit the United States for the first time in support of those doctrines which were so well established and put together in the conference 2 years ago. Of course, we're interested in the environment in general, and we participate very actively in the UN Environment Program, which was conceived in Stockholm in 1972 as a UN conference on the environment. And so we are doing all of these things, worrying about endangered species, worrying about the need to save the whales, the seals, the dolphins, the porpoises, all of these things that are of an international significance rest within the responsibility of the bureau that I head. We also have a special section that deals with Antarctica. Who would have ever thought that the State Department was concerned about Antarctica? But we are, and it is my bureau that has just finished concluding the discussions in London, which is going to establish an international agreement on what to do with the marine living resources around the Antarctic continent. And this has come about really out of necessity. You will find that in many, many cases, our governments and people are moved by necessity. And in this instance, this is a clear example of that happening, because it was discovered a few years ago that there were hundreds of thousands of tons of a living marine organism called a krill, which is a very small shrimp-looking animal. And these are being harvested by the hundreds of thousands of tons by the Polish people and by Taiwanese and others. And concern is now being expressed that some control, some regulations must be put into place in order to make sure that the harvest is not in excess of what would be the sustainable yield of that particular living organism. It's also believed that the krill developed in that area because the whales were exterminated, and that the whales in the past had kept this particular animal in balance. But with the whales being gone from the continent area, this particular animal has thrived and is now growing in huge excessive quantities. And so the Antarctic problem, as a type of global commons, is the responsibility of my bureau. We also have to do with the nuclear non-proliferation issue, worried about the development of a plutonium economy and the necessity to turn people's attentions to the problems and the difficulties that arise from a non-regulated development of a nuclear energy type situation. And so we have many officers that deal with that issue. When you look at the center of activity for this country, when you examine how it is that we have been able to progress as rapidly as we have over the past 200 years, and what you think this country epitomizes in the eyes of the foreigner, what they would like most to achieve or to have in their society, which they lack today, I think the one thing that will be singled out in almost all cases is our science and our technology. It is because of what we have been able to do in the science area, in the research area, in the development, in the technological achievements which we have been able to achieve and benefit to all of the people in our society, that we have the standard of living that we have today, that we have the jobs that we have today for our people. And this is an element of our growth, our achievement, an attribute of our society. True, it's brought many ills and many difficulties, but nevertheless, it is the one thing, I think, that distinguishes us from so many other countries. And it is the one thing in an international sense which is desired the most. And really, the most difficult part of the foreign policy of the United States to deliver, because the science and the technology which we have in this country is not owned by the government. It is owned by the private sector, by private industry, by universities, by the industrial community at large. And therefore, it is not for us as a nation to give and to offer the governments. And this makes this whole issue extremely difficult. I have a science and technology office in my bureau that handles this very complex issue on a daily basis. We attempt to solve it on a one-to-one basis, dealing with one country and attempting to enter into an agreement whereby certain kinds of scientific activities are encouraged, certain kinds of technological developments are encouraged, and in this way to develop a sort of relationship of goodwill and promotion in terms of what these countries need. But it's a very modest, a very slow, time-consuming kind of activity. And despite the demands by so many countries, we have only 26 such agreements in existence. So the real success of our ability to transfer this technology to assist countries in development, to become more industrialized, to offer job opportunities to their people and elevate their standard of living, the arena has now turned to an international sphere of the UN Conference for Science and Technology for Development. And this is a major challenge for our government, for industry, for academia, for everyone interested in promoting good relations and understanding between the developed countries and the lesser developed countries. If you have studied international relations of late, you know the great conflict between the countries that are only now rising to a state of moderate, medium development versus the countries like United States, Japan, United Kingdom, France, that have more or less graduated into a area of a developed country. The great conflict of how you bring these two societies closer together. What kinds of instruments can be used to make it possible for the developed countries to be able to transfer their science and their technology and enable some of these countries to be more self-supporting. No country that I have ever dealt with is interested in a handout or a giveaway which insults their dignity or their own abilities and their own desires to strive and make the achievement themselves. What they want is an opportunity to be able to achieve industrialization or a development in which their people can enjoy some of the conditions which we enjoy here in terms of education and housing and health and certain of the emoluments and satisfactions that we have in our society. And that is really one of the more important responsibilities in the Bureau. So you can see that my Bureau really covers the waterfront. Yet, curiously enough, and I would be the first to admit it, it is a Bureau that is really scarcely ever heard of or known about. And that, I think, comes from the fact that it does deal with a very nebulous sort of subject. And it is referred to in the Department as, quote, a functional Bureau. Anyone who has looked at the State Department or worked there or studied it knows that the activities of the State Department are divided into geographic regions. There's the Latin American Bureau, and there's the African Bureau, and the Asian Bureau, and the European Bureau, and all the activities are more or less spun out of the regional bureaus. If they see a crisis, then they are called forward to respond to it. They're sent off to the various capitals to try to find a solution, to find an accommodation to the particular problem. So that because the State Department is basically crisis-oriented and has developed a response-type mechanism, it is these regional bureaus that dominate the day-to-day work of the department. And so the two functional bureaus, mine and the one called economics, are sort of in the background. And really, in my case, was not established by the State Department at all. It was established by the Congress in 1973. And it was quite a new thing when it was put in as an amendment to a appropriations bill, and the State Department didn't know quite what to do with it. In fact, they thought, well, it would just go away. Maybe somebody will forget. they put that amendment in the law, and they won't have to do anything about it. But there was continued pressure on the State Department, so finally after a year and a half, in January of 1975, the Bureau was finally created. And so it's really been a very short period of time that it's been in existence, and so there's no wonder that very little is known about it. It is a fairly large Bureau, about 165 individuals work in it. Its first assistant secretary was none other than Dixie Lee Ray, current governor of the state of Washington. And she took hold when she left the chairmanship of the Atomic Energy Commission. She left in June of that first year of her appointment, and the position was left vacant for almost a year. It was occupied by Ambassador Irving of Finland, and he stayed in about 6 or 7 months until I came on the scene. So that is another element of the challenge which confronts me in this new position, because it is a new thing, it's a new concept, it's a new kind of approach to foreign policy which does not look to a specific country or a quid pro quo that we might be interested in our dealings with one country, or a particular immediate goal that we may be seeking in terms of foreign policy benefits. The Bureau has a responsibility to take an overview, a larger global dimension of our relationship with the world as a whole. And this I find tremendously exciting. I suppose that it's this opportunity to look at the broader picture, to look at ourselves in a larger context, that drove me in the first place to seek office in the Congress. It's not to diminish the importance of local issues, but to recognize that you are one small human being in a very large situation, and an ability to try to change that larger context in which we all live is a very exciting kind of experience. And I think that is what makes this conference such an event that I doubt that any of us will ever return back to our families and our circumstances, except that we shall be tremendously changed and affected by what we have experienced here, because what we have experienced here is a sense of belonging to something which is much larger than ourselves, much larger than our local communities. And this is really the ultimate meaning of this conference, and why we are so pleased that you're here, and why we're so delighted to have been included as a part of the whole event. Thank you very much. I'd be pleased to answer any questions or listen to your thoughts or respond to any contribution you'd like to make. Yes.
I was going to comment on the fact that Governor Ray went out to bring a thing to that job. But it occurred to me when you were talking about the vacancy that occurred in this position. So many of us are interested in getting put into the board of commissioners. How would it been if they had written and told them we were available, you know, and somebody, would they just said, well, you know, no way, you don't have enough crowd or something like that?
Well, I think that one way of approaching it is certainly through the elected office holders in Washington. I know that whenever I received letters or inquiries from people who were interested in specific appointments, we would try to go to bat for that individual. So I can't really diminish the importance of working through the elected representatives that you already have from your areas. That's their job, to seek out those positions for which you qualify and to fight for your being considered for those appointments. It's not to say that they're going to be able to guarantee you the appointment, but at least they can get your name considered and your credentials reviewed for the particular offices that you have in mind. In my case, I attribute my being called to take this job to the women's organizations that organized in the Washington area as a coalition of 40, 50 women's groups. And immediately after the November election in 1976, began intense activities to bring to the attention of the president and all of his committee people the many, many hundreds of women who were qualified for various and sundry jobs and opportunities to be members of the new administration. If it were not for the existence of this coalition of women's organizations, I dare say that I would have had an opportunity to be considered. So the fact of the organizations being in existence, I think, is the reason why so many women were successful in being considered and finally being appointed. The last count that I saw, there are 55 women presidential appointees in this administration, which is probably at least 10 times perhaps what existed in the prior administration. So there's been a tremendous move forward. That's not to say we should be content with the 55. 55-